Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're asking, how do you write true crime? It's the inescapable genre that's dominating TV screens, podcast downloads and book charts at the moment. Whether you're a serial listener, you've a vested interest in the Stephen Avery case documented in Netflix's Making a Murderer, or you're just thirsty for a good twisted tale. True crime seems to have hooked audiences all over the world. On today's show, we're going to look into what it is that intrigues and fascinates people so much about this genre and how the people involved go about making it. We'll meet a woman whose love of true crime turned her into an author. We'll head to Brazil, where the high crime rate is used as a cheap form of entertainment, and we'll delve into the relationship between the people who solve the mystery and the people who want to put it on screen over in Malaysia. So hold tight while we go true detective and listen as the pieces of the jigsaw fall into place on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. First up, we need to work out why we love a murder mystery. A few months ago on this programme, we made a show about morbid fascination, where we discovered that people are fascinated by danger because it's how we learn what's right from what's wrong. But this programme is looking more at the media that becomes a product of that. Ever since Serial came along, everyone's looking for the next big murder drama to get hooked on. But is it just a fad? The most recent show to come from the Serial team is S-Town. It's billed as true crime, but meanders from the genre to be a masterclass in writing about a character, which can be the most central part of writing about mysterious goings-on. We asked arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph, Alice Vincent, why we're all so into true crime.
I think people have always been fascinated by true crime. I mean, you know, there's a reason why those books, those creepy books exist of how murderers were happening. There's a reason why detective plays were big in the early 20th century. People are always fascinated by the grisly. True crime might be the latest adaptation of, say, what Nordic Noir was doing a few years ago. I think people are fascinated by a grisly true crime story. And furthermore, emergent kind of media markets, so Netflix and podcasts, This American Life, have the capabilities and the freedom to make them.
Do you think, though, with people watching these things, listening to these things, reading these things, and also having one hand on their phones and being able to Google things, that everyone feels like their own detective? After the S-Town came out, people were going out and actively trying to seek out information about all the characters.
Well, this happened with Serial as well, and I do think this is a kind of an area we have to tread carefully. Of course, with Serial, the Reddit threads were dissecting it, much like the Reddit threads dissect Game of Thrones or any other pop culture phenomenon. But the same has happened with S-Town, and so people were getting into the Facebook pages of the people in this podcast, and they were posting photos, and these photos were shared around the internet. And I still think I've reported on this as well, but it's difficult to do so without thinking there is a person who has no idea this is going on at the heart of this.
I guess with things like Serial and Making a Murderer, these are both examples of things that have been made and people have indulged in, and then they've actually changed the course of the cases that they're talking about. Where should the line be between proper detective work and journalism?
I think in the UK, at least, there's quite strong media law to stop too much contempt of court and digging around and going where we're maybe not meant to be going. That's not the case everywhere, and I do appreciate that. I think we've got to see that there's also a benefit side to it, with Adnan Syed, who was the convicted murderer in Serial. He's been given an appeal. His case has been overlooked. That's a really good thing. I think, as with anything, be careful what you read on the internet.
What do you think is about these real-life stories that really capture people's imagination as opposed to a fictionalised drama?
I think it's got that extra... I mean, as we were saying, you know, this is novelistic. This S-Town would work as a fascinating novel, but I think it's an extra punch of, like, and it really happened. There is that... It makes us be able to relate to it. These people kind of are larger than maybe what someone's fiction could create. We hear their real voices. There's no acting, there's no pretense. And I think that makes it extra interesting.
Why do you think that the US have been so much better at doing this than the UK recently? Do you think that it's something to do with, rather than just, you know, America's got a better podcast industry than the UK, but is it something about the American sensibility and American storytelling that makes it better?
I do think there's a bit of that. I mean, it's got to be said, people working on their own patch in local newspaper industry and local journalism in the UK are unlikely to get any of the really weird, very strange cases that we have seen reported in American local press for decades. Even going back to, like, Truman Capote in Cold Blood, it's kind of ingrained into that storytelling and that journalistic culture, which I just don't think it is here. You know, we've got the Penny Dreadful legacy. It all seems a bit, it just doesn't seem like a very British thing. And I don't think that we don't have the capabilities of it. And as you say, we don't have the podcasts for it. But our issues seem somehow more humdrum. I think it might even be a geographical thing. There's just fewer of us and there's less weird open space for these things to take place.
Finally, do you think with cases like this and stories like this and dramatising them, do you think the strengths lie in a good murder case or a character that people want to get to know?
You've got one example with S-Town, you've got one example of Serial. I think at the end of the day, it comes down to how you tell a story. And to many people who are getting that email from John B. McLemore, would have just thought, this guy's a nutter, delete. But the important thing is that Brian Reed didn't. And for the same case that with Serial, that case was tracked down and drilled into rather than just become another million, one of the cases that sits lingering in the US judiciary system.
The Telegraph's Alice Vincent there. Now, our next guest on the show, Emma Flint, is a true crime fan. In fact, her encyclopedic knowledge of real-life murder cases is what prompted her to quit her day job and pen her first novel, Little Deaths. This is based on the tale of Alice Crimmins, a young mother in 1960s New York who was accused of the murder of her two children. The lack of evidence in the trial and the amount of bias from the media and police against Crimmins made for a shaky verdict. And while we still don't really know if she was guilty or not, one thing was true. Alice Crimmins should have had a fairer trial. Emma Flint tells producer Holly about how she fictionalised the story of Crimmins into that of Ruth Malone to really delve into this mysterious character. But first, what was the initial draw of true crime for Flint?
I studied history at university, and I think for me there's a really strong element of social history. You get the most extraordinary, really detailed glimpses into something, a specific afternoon or a day or a week or whatever, decades ago. And you can find out weird things like, you know, how much a pint of milk cost or how long it took a bus to get from a certain place to another place. Things that it's really difficult to find in history books because that kind of information just isn't recorded. It's not political history or economic history. It's the history of how people actually lived and obviously died. And it's those kind of details that really interest me. And then also there's obviously the crime element. There's the idea that something really horrific or extraordinary or psychologically interesting happened and that someone who committed a really horrible crime, it didn't come out of the imagination of a novelist. It actually happened in real life.
And so what do you think then that true crime stories can do that completely fictional crime doesn't?
I think the most interesting true crime cases, and I don't mean ones that I find interesting, I mean in terms of the books that have been written and the articles that have been written, are the unsolved ones. And they're the ones that there really isn't a neat ending for. So if you look at the number of books that have been written about Jack the Ripper, it's just extraordinary. I was looking at another one the other day by Patricia Cornwell. I don't think we'll ever find the answer to that, which is quite sad. But I think it's just too late. I think if we were going to find the clue, then we would have found it by now.
And that brings us on to your book, Little Deaths, which is based on the real-life case of Alice Crimmins, who was accused of murdering her two children in New York in the 1960s. This is quite famously a sort of inconclusive case, really. Is that what drew you to it?
No. What really interested me was two things. Firstly, I read about it when I was about 15 or 16, and I had an image in my head of this very attractive, tiny, petite woman in tight clothing, very striking looking, lots of makeup, teased hair, walking down a path surrounded by these big men in suits and uniforms, like big, bulky men, making her look even smaller. And I had this visual image in my head that was really strong and really striking. The other thing I remembered was when she gave her statement to the police about what had happened during the last 24 hours of her children's life, she told them that she'd fed them veal for dinner. And obviously you would expect her to remember that because it was the last meal that she had with them. But that's not what they found during the autopsy. And I found that discrepancy really fascinating. You know, when you read a crime novel, you're always looking for who's lying. It's always about, there's always somebody who's lying. There's usually, in a good crime novel, there's lots of people who are lying for various reasons, and one of the reasons will be that they killed the victim and they're trying to cover it up. In this case, I thought this is a really stupid lie to tell because, well, firstly, the police could prove it, and secondly, it didn't exonerate her in any way. If she'd lied to give herself an alibi, I could have understood it, but that was just a weird discrepancy that, off the top of my head, I couldn't account for. And I thought, whatever solution I come up with in the book, whatever resolution I give to the story, I have to find a way to answer this, and in a way that's satisfying for me.
This book is a piece of fiction, even though it's based on a real case. How responsible do you feel to stick to the facts and the actual original story?
I stuck to the facts whenever I could, unless there was a good reason to divert from them. I think what I've done is to flesh out the parts that weren't covered in the trial or in the press. So to give Alice, or Ruth in my book, character beyond the newspaper reports and beyond the trial transcript, and to try and make her a living, breathing character in fiction the way that anyone who makes up a fictional character does. Did I feel a responsibility? I did, in the sense that I tried very hard not to dwell on the details of the children's deaths. I thought that was quite an important thing not to do, not to sort of linger on all the gory details of it. That didn't seem to add anything to the story. I also felt it was important not to sensationalise any of the details. I think the story itself, the fact that you have this woman who was identified as a key suspect by the police, apparently to the press, before they even knew that the children were dead, is fairly sensational in itself. I really felt that the story didn't need more sensationalising. What I wanted to do was go deeper into the characters and try and make them people that the reader could empathise with and maybe understand.
Other books have been written about this case, other non-fiction books. What did you feel like when you set out to write about this you wanted to offer that wasn't already available?
I didn't actually sit down to write a book about the Alice Crimmins case. I read about it and a line stuck in my head, which was something like, makeup was an important part of Alice's routine or Alice's character. I wanted to ask the question of what kind of woman becomes the police suspect in the murders of her children before they've even been identified as dead. And I wanted to look at the kind of woman she was and the kind of woman that might find herself in that situation. It was literally years before about two years before I started to think, this is more than a character study or an exercise in creative writing. There's actually a story here, and it's more than a short story. I think the other thing that's important about this book and writing it now is we've come to realise far more than we did in the 60s or the 70s how the media portrayal of an individual can influence public perception, particularly women, and particularly when they are notorious for something. So either they're involved in a crime like Amanda Knox or Kate McCann, or, you know, there are women like Princess Diana or Kim Kardashian who's being, the focus is on her because of how they look or how they act or the relationships they've been in or who they've slept with. And I think it's quite interesting that the portrayal of men and women in that way is still different, and especially in crimes. So if you look at the way that Kate McCann was portrayed compared to her husband, the focus on how she looked, you know, photographs of her going out jogging and not wearing makeup or photographs of her wearing mascara, these things are completely irrelevant to whether she committed a crime or not. And the same with Amanda Knox. There was a focus on the number of men she'd slept with that had really nothing to do with whether she'd committed that particular murder or not.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, actually, because for me, reading that book, the most shocking parts of it were the description of the main character, Ruth Malone, by the police, by the media, by reporters. Those were the bits that really got to me. So did you feel like you wanted to stick up for Ruth Malone in this book?
Yeah, definitely. When I read about it, I remember feeling really strongly, I don't know whether she did it or not, but she didn't get a fair hearing. She didn't get a fair trial in the sense of a trial by media, a trial before she actually was in the courtroom. I felt that she was judged on how she looked, how she behaved, the fact that she refused to cry publicly, the fact that she behaved in a way that was unconventional even before the children disappeared.
Did you have to do much of your own detective work for this, or did you just take the character and run?
I basically took the character and ran. I don't feel that I uncovered new evidence or anything, except in the sense of looking at the characters involved and the main suspects involved, reading what I could about them, the way that you do in a detective story, I guess, and making up my own mind and thinking, well, yes, she could have done it, but based on the evidence, so could other people. I still don't quite understand, having done all of that, why she's the one that went to trial.
I just wanted to know about your own consumption of true crime media. Do you listen to things like Serial? Do you watch documentaries? Or are you purely in the library reading lots of books?
I much prefer books. I think maybe, I don't know, maybe it's my age, maybe it's how I started out, but I've been reading true crime books for 30 years, and that's definitely the medium that I feel comfortable in. I'm writing my second novel, which is about a male killer who I think was psychopathic, and I've been watching lots of YouTube videos of interviews with people like Ted Bundy and Charles Manson, which has been, you can't get that stuff from a book, even when you read the transcript of the interview. There's something about watching how they interact with the interviewer, the facial tics, the way that they don't meet eye contact or they do meet eye contact. It's really interesting to watch those kinds of videos and actually hear them talk about their crimes in their own words. It's quite often difficult to listen to. It's really interesting. It's something that I can't get from a book. Things like Serial and Making a Murderer, I did enjoy them, but I felt like the case was being presented at one remove. So you have a narrator, or you have a reporter or a lawyer narrating what's happened. And you do get that from a book, but personally I found that quite disruptive. I'd rather read the story for myself and make up my own mind than have somebody on screen telling it to me.
That was Emma Flint, author of Little Deaths, which is published now by Picador. We now turn our gaze to TV-obsessed Brazil. The country's famed over-the-top dramatic telenovelas still reign supreme. They're the country's most popular shows. But what's also popular is Brazil's version of true crime. Sensationalist real-life stories meet news programmes that are purely focused on the country's high crime rate. It's a genre that originally started on the radio, but then translated quickly over to TV in the early 90s, shortly after the dictatorship finished. Ever since then, these programmes have remained as regular after-work dinner table programming on the nation's public television channels. Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Rossiter tells us about Brazil's true crime obsession and why these shows work so well with the Brazilian psyche.
Uma sexta-feira muito triste.
It's become a decades-long tradition. The after-work reality check meets a form of cheap, factual, and grueling entertainment in many Brazilian households. These sometimes nearing two-hour true crime programs blare out of television screens across the nation, bringing Brazilians the latest news on the most gruesome and horrific crimes every Monday to Saturday in the early evening. And with a flair for the dramatic, those true crime shows blend together the drama element of the country's famed telenovelas with factual journalism of the day's news coming out of a violent country.
Você não vai falar? Não foi você que matou a menina.
And the king and originator of that on Brazilian TV was Gil Gomez.
Esta história dá arrepios só de nela pensar, relembrar. Era uma noite escura.
In 1991, Aqui Agora, Here and Now, became the first televised true crime journalism show, which Brazilians were already used to hearing on the radio.
A criança levada. Os policiais, então. A notícia é para a mulher. A criança estava bem. Dona.
Broadcast on one of Brazil's public TV channels, SBT, Aqui Agora came just a few years after Cops hit the airways in the US. But Aqui Aguada took a different approach to telling these stories of crime. Unlike Cops, where TV crews would film police in action, Aqui Aguada would mix Brazil's sensationalism from its novellas via a flamboyant TV presenter who would simply be reporting the facts of the day's events, cutting out all the boring chit-chat that can sometimes be seen on Cops.
E outros policiais foram até o carro acidentado.
With no shortage of gory imagery, lots of blood, and even sometimes showing dead bodies, Gil Gomez would tell the story of these crimes, naming the victim and telling their ages, all over top of tones of mood music. And the Brazilian public quickly tuned in to the lesser-known SBT network to watch Aqui Agora.
A delegacia da cidade onde o caso foi registrado com frequência para obter informações e acompanhar a investigação. Mas, segundo ela, a busca pelos suspeitos segue a passos lentos.
Just a few years later, in 1995, Regirecord, Brazil's second-largest public broadcaster after Globo, launched Cidade Alerta. City on Alert, its own version of Aqui Agora.
Brincadeira, né, ó. Me ajuda aí, ó. Desce o TP aí. Bandido semi-analfabeto é inocentado por ser réu primário.
2 years after that, the public network Banji got on board too, launching Brasil Urgente, Urgent Brazil, with this time adding in a helicopter to follow the police chases live as they happen through Brazil's city streets.
Perseguição no helicóptero, olha só a correria na zona norte de São Paulo. Ah lá o Veloster, não é o carro procurado pela polícia? Aí, olha, não é esse o carro procurado pela polícia?
And these are just a few true crime journalism shows in Brazil. The list goes on.
Será que é o bandido? Atenção, imagem exclusiva, helicóptero do Brasil Urgente, comandante Fernando, Sérgio, mostrando para
você. And it didn't take long for all these true crime sensationalism to create active imaginations among some of the show's presenters.
O dia começou movimentado em frente ao prédio da Assembleia Legislativa do Amazonas. Estudantes de uma escola estadual foram até o local.
In 2009, it was revealed that then 58-year-old Wallace Souza, presenter of Canal Livre, Free Channel, was running a death squad that would go out and commit murders, which would then be tipped off to the channel's TV crew to get a scoop before the police arrived. For Souza, a former policeman turned TV show host, the murders were all in the name of ratings for his show that was on Brazilian airways for around 20 years. In an ironic twist, Souza's tale of murders for ratings then became a topic of its own on other true crime magazine shows.
O marido dela, Valderlândia Araújo, são achados munição de uso restrito, pasta de cocaína e dinheiro.
The true crime journalism that floods Brazil's public TV channels at dinner time shows a clear taste for Brazil's own blend of true crime, which, unfortunately, uses the country's perpetual violence as a means of entertainment. And with 19 of the world's most deadly cities being in Brazil, there is certainly no shortage of content.
O cara da política, vagabundo. Iano Sérgio, direto de Manaus. Quer dizer que o Iano.
But in a country where subscriptions to on-demand streaming services like Netflix are soaring, a sharp turn away from public broadcasters might be a driving force that might make some of these true crime sensationalist journalism shows change their image and tune in order to keep fading ratings up.
Não atinge ali o motoqueiro, ele tá dando volta em círculos, ali tá fazendo círculos no quarteirão.
For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thanks, Sheena. To end the show, then, we go to the Malaysian capital, Kuala Lumpur, where two filmmakers are turning one of their true crime documentaries into a fictional TV series. It draws on the story of a man who attacked 33 women in a case that locals widely believed was mired in black magic. Two decades on, the production team are using the very detective who eventually cracked the case using forensics to cut through superstition. He's also the man who'll become a central character on the show. It's not always about true crime, but sometimes about the guy who solved it. Reporter Preeti Jha finds out how they're collaborating to bring this intriguing real-life drama onto the screen.
I must look at the back of this house.
Actually, a lot of the original facts we kept. In fact, some of the more amazing stuff is the real-life stuff.
A team of writers are thrashing out the first draft of their script for a TV crime series, advised by the detective who led the case.
I must know the victim is pure virgin.
It's based on a serial rapist who terrorised Malaysians in and around Kuala Lumpur 2 decades ago.
At that time, it was very, very sensitive.
Retired police officer Amidon Anan tells me why he's helping filmmakers fictionalise one of his most challenging investigations.
Our intention is to educate the public so that let the public understand the difficulties, the up and down of any particular case or any serial cases. This is what we need.
In this case, one of his challenges was finding physical evidence for crimes that victims always relayed in terms of black magic, testimonies that wouldn't stand up in court.
The most important thing is don't mess up the crime scene. That's all I want. Now, who doesn't want to clean up the house? Sometimes when we reach the scene, everything has been cleared, everything has been washed, and these are the problems.
He likes to share as much detail as possible to help the writers visualise what he lived through in a series where the main character is built around him.
I go 100%. The case has been for more than 20 years. So I have to tell the scriptwriter A to Z, 100%, nothing to hide. Because we are not going to jeopardise anybody. To me, we are going to educate the public so that they understand what we as an investigator want.
But while he shares a strong rapport with a team he's worked with on previous documentaries, Anan admits he's unsure how they'll translate his real-life experiences into a fictional drama. In the edit suite, filmmakers Ahmed Yazid and Rob Nevis are reviewing interviews from their original documentary. Fiction offers them a fresh medium to explore issues triggered by the crime.
We're trying to poke our society. Supernatural belief had affected investigations. And the police could not stop it because this has always been in our psyche. We are a superstitious person. Then we look at a crime in a superstitious way, with the glasses of superstition. A simple case can be blown out of proportion because of hearsay. That is the kind of thing that we want to poke.
The series is also a nod to Anand's influence on Malaysian policing.
We've interviewed this policeman before on 2 previous cases, well-known cases. So he's not a stranger to us. And when I was writing this, the fiction outline, I thought, okay, I got to pay homage.
He's quite a legend in the police force here. He was one of the pioneers of the forensic department in Malaysia. And this forensic lab, under his guidance, had solved many cases, that big profile cases in the past. And, you know, you can mention his name in the police force. Almost everyone knows him.
Working with the original detective has helped bring authenticity to a well-known case. But the scriptwriters are also relying on fictionalised elements for characters to evolve over an 8-part series.
So he is the hero of the film, the investigating officer. But when it came to building up the offender's character, we had to give it life. So the backstory is from a different case. We studied so many criminals. So we take little pieces from there and put it together, and we build up his character, because it's going to be an 8-episode series. So each character has to be meaty.
Oh, you mentioned 33. That we reported cases on.
The team plans to start filming this summer, hoping their series both intrigues and educates at a time when Malaysian audiences, like those world over, are increasingly turning to true crime dramas. For Monocle, in Kuala Lumpur, I'm Preeti Jha.
Thanks to Preeti Jha for that report. So, how do you write true crime then? Well, you need a cunning, mysterious or intelligent character at the centre of it who's either going to wreak havoc or solve the mystery. You need a tale with plenty of twists and turns, but the thing that seems to keep most people tuned in is writing about something that's unsolved. There are plenty of listeners, readers and viewers out there poised and ready to apply their own assumptions and detective work to a case. Recently, we've seen podcasts and TV series changing the course of trials, and now everyone wants a piece of the action. We're not suggesting that you jump into a fresh case to start creating your own line of inquiry, but writing about a case with an ambiguous ending seems to be what captures the imagination of the listener. And we all know what a simple ending would be. Criminal. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was Holly watching the detectives Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.